Well, welcome back to the Avery Adventures podcast. As always, we're brought to you by MountainOps.com and BertramBrass.com. This is the seminar that Robbie gave at the Western Hunting Expo. It's Tagging Big Mule Deer, the Where and the How. There is a few spots in here where we fast-forwarded it because it didn't make sense to have some of it in an audio-formatted podcast. So I guess all podcasts are audio-formatted. But you'll see we jumped ahead a few times, but we tried to make it make sense. And there's a lot of good information in this seminar that Robbie gave down there. So here you go.
All right. What are you thinking of the expo so far? The best horn porn in the West is what I say. Well, thanks for coming out. A few more people will drift in, but I got a lot of content to cover here, so I want to jump right into it. First of all, I want to give a big thanks to Mark Smith. He's probably hiding in here somewhere. I would not be up here talking to you all if it wasn't for him. So big hand for Mark. Okay, so kind of an inside joke here. Some of you aren't going to get this, but for those of you that have been part of this whole legend thing that has been launched on me, the true legend is Ryan Avery, okay? I've never been on the Jumbotron at the SHOT Show. I've got evidence right there. There's the hashtags. I would appreciate any of you that know him or that follow him to go ahead and let him know we're passing the torch. And I've never been on TV either. And he will be on the Swarovski TV this summer. So when he tells you I'm the legend, oh, no, I'm not the legend. He's the real legend, okay? So you Rock Slide guys, get that out there for him. Okay, so the seminar, Tagging Big Mule Deer, the where and the how. That's what we'll be talking about today. I receive hundreds of questions a year about hunting big deer. And the underlying theme is almost always, where should I hunt? And that's an important question, but I think there's a better question to ask, and that's how should I hunt? That's really where my focus is most of the time. And the reason for that is because draw odds have plummeted, all right? 25, 30 years ago, I've got some friends out here that were deer hunting then. We didn't think too much about the draw tags like we do now. There weren't that many. Most of the states were managed OTC in some form or another. And then with, you know, the decline in mule deer, more stricter management, the draw hunts got really popular. And while the odds have always been bad, when I was a little kid, they were bad. I remember my uncles in the 70s crying big old tears because they couldn't draw a mule deer tag. But they're really bad now. And so I think we've kind of come back full circle to needing to include some of these OTC or easier to get tags, not necessarily OTC, because there's other options out there, you know, with some of the low point units, you know, landowner tags, things like that. We'll talk about that more as we get into it. But my draw strategies, it's like a diversified investment portfolio. I've got applications in most of the Western states, maybe not every year, but most years. And I'll be in units from some very low odds draw, some hard to draw tags. I'll have applications in those units. I've chased those units too, all the way down to OTC. So if you were to look at how I apply in the draws, it's not just the Hail Marys, because that's what I've learned in the last 15, 20 years. You're not going to pull those tags very often. And even when you do, there's some inherent problems with draw tags. We'll talk about that more. And so that's why I say I think there's just too much focus on that. In this seminar, I'll be covering case studies on the last four big bucks that I've killed, and this was between 2015 and 2018. And my draw odds averaged 72%. One of them was one of those really hard to draw tags at 7%. One of them was 100% draw odds tag in the landowner system. And don't just groan about that. Lots of people play the landowner system. It's not as hard as you think, and there's more opportunity out there than you think. Not all the good landowner tags cost $12,000, trust me. I had another tag in these four bucks that was 80% draw at 6 points, because I am building points in some states. And then one of the bucks we'll talk about was on 100% OTC, over-the-counter, not sexy, not fun, over-hunted type of deal. But you'll see in this seminar how I piece all those together. Draw odds can't be our only barrier to entry. A lot of people think about draw hunts as, you know, that's a barrier to entry for hunters. You know, they can't get into the unit, they can't draw it, so therefore if I could just get that tag, I could get in there and kill a big buck. Well, I've had a few of those good tags over the years, and I've found it's not that easy. And I look for other barriers to entry that make it hard for people to hunt a certain place. That could be low success rate on bucks. It doesn't have to be a great unit to grow big mule deer. And that's really what this seminar is about. Older age class, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year old bucks. And some units scare hunters away because you just don't see a lot of deer. I'm not afraid to hunt units like that and scout them and look at them, because sometimes that's all it takes to get a buck into that 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 year old range. Rough country, downhill. Most guys aren't afraid to walk uphill with a backpack on because they know if they kill something, they can bring it down. But standing on the top of a 10,000 foot peak looking down at deer country that's 3,000 feet below you, now that takes a pair to walk down there. And so I always try to find places like that, because there may be there could be a road on top, but typically 1,000 feet and below that, there's not very many guys willing to go down there. So I always look for that as a barrier to entry. Backcountry, obviously, I think a backcountry is, you know, 2 to 10 miles from the road. It's more popular than ever, but I still find that older age class bucks in the backcountry. You can't hunt on Snob Hill in the backcountry where everybody goes. You can't do that, but I'm just saying don't go in the backcountry, have a bad experience because you saw several camps in there and think, well, it's all bad. It's not all bad. Extreme hot and cold, hunting in the late summer, you Nevada guys, Jimmy, you've experienced this, you know, 100 degree temps, that's hard to hunt in. But I find there might be a lot of guys out hunting in those extreme temperatures, but they're not very effective. They're pretty close to the pickup. So I'm always looking for dates that allow me to hunt in extreme conditions, because it gives me advantage over guys that want to be more comfortable. Limited water, I don't just mean limited water for the deer, but for the hunters. This is particularly in the backcountry. Some places there's hunters, but they're not very effective because they can't stay there all day because there's just not enough water. They can't camp there. So I look for places like that. And sometimes that's just a little side canyon. Mark talked earlier today that with the Wasatch, there's no water up there, which is amazing to me. And you know, a lot of guys to hunt places like that have to pack water in. That's what I'm talking about. Do whatever it takes to be able to get to where less people are. Weapon choice, if you're only going to hunt rifle, or you're only going to hunt muzzleloader, or you're only going to hunt archery, you're limiting yourself. I think you need to be more flexible than that as a big deer hunter. Grizzly bears, that's kind of the new kid on the block, and I'm meeting hunters and hearing of places now where people don't want to go hunt because there's grizzly bears. I get all that, but I'm starting to watch those areas, because sometimes it doesn't take much less hunting pressure to grow a big buck. Sometimes just an ebb in hunting pressure, because if a buck gets to 4 or 5 years old, he learns how to hide. They get past 3 years old and they're not just standing out there on the side of the road. So I'm not afraid to hunt places with grizzly bears. Willingness to hunt solo, if you're only going to hunt with a buddy, you're still limiting yourself. Some of my best hunts are with friends. I really, really enjoy that and I prefer it. But the draw odds are so bad, and even on some of these easier to get tags, you're lowering your draw odds in some of these states by applying with a friend. Like Colorado, if you have 3 points, you want to hunt with your friend and he has one, you got to go in at his level. And so I always think about that stuff as I'm applying, and I'm not afraid to hunt alone. I don't want to, but I'm not afraid to do it, because there's a lot of guys that won't. Private land, don't just think, oh, private land, that's all taken up, you can't get on it unless you're outfitter. No, that's not true. I've gotten on some great ranches over the years. Well, I built a lot of free fence, trained horses for guys, did things, whatever it took to be able to access property. Not all private land's very good though. Some of it gets as hunted as hard as the public land, so you gotta be careful about that. But don't just rule it out. Landowner tags, I talked about that. One of my best typicals came off of a landowner tag that I bought for less than $1,000 in a unit that can be drawn on 1 point. Okay, so you don't wanna rule that out. Your ability to pre-scout too. I hear a lot of excuses when it comes to scouting. All the hardcore guys I know, they scout. But I'll get guys that'll draw a good tag and they're like, well, it's not open until third season Colorado, so I'm not gonna scout it because the deer aren't there. I don't think that way. I think, man, I want to show up with as much intel and recon as I have. You only have a limited amount of time to spend in your unit. And once the buzzer sounds on opening day, you don't have time to be out learning country and switching areas and all that stuff. So when I'm scouting, it's not just for a certain buck, but it's learning the country. Okay. There's millions of acres open to this kind of hunting. All right. And that's why I don't want to just keep the focus on draw tags. If you go to the top, you know, all the draw tags in the West that are 5% draw odds or better, we're probably talking about 20 units out there, 25 units, something like that. Did you see all the guys applying for the validating their expo tags down there? looks like an anthill. I mean, that's a visual representation of what the draw odds look like for some of these top-end hunts. But there's millions of acres open to the type of hunting that I'm talking about. And you're going to spend most of your deer hunting days in units like that because that's where you can get the tag. Unless you're wealthy or very, very lucky, that's where you're going to be hunting most years. I had my friends over at Go Hunt. They are in booth. What are you, Brady? 834, thank you. They're in booth 834. I had them use their filtering 2.0 with some of the criteria that I gave them to give a representation, I think I got 10 Western states in here, of units that would qualify for the type of hunting that I'm talking about. So for this one, this was from a non-resident perspective for Arizona, and a resident would only have better odds in the Western states. Mule deer, obviously 1 point or less, or 25% chance of drawing or better, and 30 to 100% public land, and with a 30 to 100% success rate. Did I explain that right, Brady? Okay, so we put that into their filter, boom, it kicked out those units in Arizona. I've never been to a single one of those, but I guarantee you, you give me a year or two in one of those, I'm going to find some of the better bucks in the unit using the techniques that I'm going to talk about in this seminar. And it's not just Arizona. Even the lowly state of California, oh, I can hear the groans in the back, has got places like this. And I follow a few guys that are down there, and as bad as it is, they still seem to be killing some of the top-end bucks out of areas like that. What do we got there? Colorado. My goodness, I guarantee that world record that's sitting right there in the pending world record, potential world record, however you want to look at it, right as you walk in there, I guarantee it was killed in one of those units. Colorado is our deer factory, offers the most opportunity. And now you might be thinking, wait a minute, I've been trying to draw Colorado for years. What's going on? It's because I'm listing archery, second rifle, third rifle, muzzleloader, every opportunity to hunt down there. And you can see some of those. I see 44 on there. Everybody's talking about 44. Well, how did it pop up? Go look at the odds for an archery tag and a muzzleloader tag in there. It'll shock you. Idaho, known as a OTC state for the most part, but when I filter it through Go Hunt's filters there, you can see it just narrowed it down to, I don't know, 8 units or something. Those are the units where I would focus if I was coming to Idaho. Montana, lots of opportunity there. I realize they hunt their bucks in the rut, but I still, every year, I meet guys that are in the know that kill big bucks out of some of these places. Nevada, really hard to get tags in there, but through that filtering system, a lot of those are archery tags, I agree, but that's why I said you got to be willing to be flexible. If you're only going to hunt with your rifle, yep, the good old days are gone. But if you're willing to be flexible, look at the access to the tags that you have in there. I guarantee there's some giants in every one of those units. I've heard people in the know say there's probably a 190 buck in every single one of those units that I just listed on public land. Okay, gonna be hard to hunt them. Extreme hot, extreme cold, might have to go bow equipment, but they're still out there for the taking if guys wanna do it. New Mexico, I don't know a whole lot about New Mexico, but my friend Mark does. You've hunted in some of those units, haven't you?
Been in a few of
them. There you go, buddy. And so they're there, guys. I got a picture of a 33-incher last November killed on public land in New Mexico, and the guy claimed it was just buy the tag and go. He was a resident. Knew what he was doing. Oregon, those units come up. Utah, don't anybody throw an egg at me. You got to admit, though, Utah has put out some of its better bucks in the last 5 years out of some of their non-sexy Ponsagant, Elk Ridge, Henry's. And I think, weather permitting and God willing, it's just going to get better because they're managing them now. Wyoming. Notice region G and H that get all the press aren't even listed on there. It filtered them out because from a non-resident perspective, it takes 2, 3, 4 years to get them. Worse for H. And that's not the only place that big bucks are grown. Go to Ryan Hatch's booth. Have him show you that great big non-typical that was on there a couple of years ago in Wyoming. 240, 250, I can't even remember. It was killed in one of those units. Every resident in here could hunt that unit. Okay, here's a couple bucks I've taken in the last 15 years just on easy to get tags. Archery, 0 point. And by the way, that archery tag takes about 3 points for rifle. Muzzleloader, 1 preference point. Rifle, had to wait 3 years for that one. I've killed most of my bucks on hunts like that don't take a ton of points. You have to You have to polish your deer hunting skills, and that's really what we're talking about here today. I'd love to have a Henry's tag, but if I hadn't hunted deer for 15 years and somebody offered me a Henry's tag, I wouldn't be prepared to do it. You're gonna hone your skills and cut your teeth in a lot of those units that I'm talking about, because I really think you got to hunt deer every year if you want to be at the top of your game, okay? Lucky draws are not repeatable, but good hunting techniques are, and that's going to lead us into the heart of this seminar, and that's the how of killing deer, big deer. For those of you that have read my book, you'll recognize those techniques. They're right out of my book. And we're going to, over these next four buck stories, I'll show you how I used each of those techniques in combination or alone to take these next four bucks. I'll just give you a quick summary of each of them. Moving in deer country. A human being in deer country is like a tuba in the Rose Parade, all right? We take our pace of daily life and we go into the woods. Deer hear us, smell us, they know we're there. And we think we're only spooking the deer that we see. No, when a deer spooks, it sends out a concentric circle through the forest. All the animals go on alert. And one of the most alert animals in the forest is a big mule deer. Would you dispute that, Mark? You've hunted all the big species. Yeah, they don't put up with much, okay? So how we move in deer country matters, okay? Obeying the wind. What I mean by that is I let the wind decide how I'm going to hunt a particular area, okay? Before I enter it, I'm going to make sure I got the wind in my favor. That sounds basic, but what I find in the younger me, I only paid attention to the wind after I spotted the buck. Then I started thinking about the wind. I think... And I can prove through many of my hunts, we're spooking deer we don't even see by not paying attention to the wind, especially in brushy units with a lot of cover. Okay? Glassing, I put duh next to that one because that's what we get stuck doing. Okay? If you're going to be spending your time deer hunting in a lot of these units that I just put up there, glassing can't be your only technique. Why? Because the old bucks are not living in the open. If they were, they would be dead. That's for the really good draw hunts without a lot of hunters in the field. Glassing is important. It's still your number one technique. I would never dispute that. And I spend a lot of time doing it. But my point is you can't just glass. You got to apply these other techniques. Tracking, that's kind of a dying art. And I think it's because glassing replaced it. 40 years ago when nobody had good optics, they just naturally followed the deer tracks. I mean, I remember looking through my dad's binoculars when I was a kid. I mean, it was like looking through a kaleidoscope. And so nobody spent any time glassing. They were all tracking. But as glassing has got more popular and easier, I don't find very many guys following deer tracks around. Still hunting, it's not very popular, it's not very fun, but it's still the only way to kill some of these big bucks in units like this because they end up living in the cover during legal shooting hours. So you gotta get in their living room to kill them, and still hunting is the best way to do it in some cases. Ambush hunting, what I mean by that, I'm not talking about spotting a buck and sneaking down there and waiting for him to get up and shoot him. That's spot and stalk. That ties into glassing. Ambush hunting, I'm talking about taking all the intel of the area that you know. That could be previous sightings of bucks, tracks, rubs, maybe intel from friends that are willing to share with you. Mark relies a lot on friends when he's traveling out of state talking to guys. They'll give you hints and stuff like that. But ambush hunting is taking all that and putting it together and figuring out where you can be and not move, not be seen, not be smelled, and let the deer do the moving. And there's at least one buck in this seminar, I don't think he could have been killed any other way but ambush hunting. Knowing the area's true potential. A lot of times we're out there chasing unicorns. And this really applies to some of the draw tags. Is, oh, I got a draw tag now, man. I'm going to shoot a 200 or less. Well, some of these places, there hasn't been a 200-inch buck killed in 15 years, even if it's a draw tag. So you got to really know what the area's potential is. Not everywhere can grow good bucks like that, even if it's heavily managed. And I see a lot of guys every year really disappointed on draw tags because they let bucks walk. They thought there was a bigger one out there. We'll talk about that more as we get in here. Then quickly estimating actual antler size. You'll see in these next four bucks that I'm going to show you at least three of them, if not all four of them, I just had seconds to decide on whether I was going to kill that buck or I was going to invest my entire hunt in him. I used to get this kind of romantic idea that, oh, you know, the buck, he's going to stand up there. I'm going to put my big Zeiss's on him and, you know, I'm going to score this point and that point and match them all up. And that's his weak side. Oh, man, you know what? I gave up on that 20 years ago. Bucks that live in units like this, they don't give you a lot of time. They don't spend a lot of time out of the cover or out during legal shooting time. So you got to be quick. And we'll talk about that more as we go into this. These big bucks. focus. That's all I do. You can ask my wife. I don't do anything else. I just hunt big deer. I gave up elk hunting. I love steelhead fishing. I don't do that anymore. If kids want to go fishing, I'll take them. But I don't put one day towards any other species. It's not that I don't like any other species. I really do. But hunting big deer is tough. Any day I'm out hunting bears, turkeys, elk, that's one day I'm not focusing on deer hunting, even if deer season isn't open, because all those other pursuits take what? Time and money. A lot of people ask me, why don't you hunt elk? Honey, are you going to let me take another 20 days off of fall so that I can go hunt elk? I can tell you the answer on that. She'd say yes because she's sweet, but she would be like, oh, here we go again. Okay? So hunting big mule deer takes a lot of focus. I can't apologize for that, but it does. And only you can decide if other hunting pursuits are taken away from that focus. Okay? So here we are. We're going to break down my last four good bucks. Okay? Took that buck in 2015 and even though I've been talking about kind of leaning towards getting more tags more often, I still apply for these hard to get tags. And by Lord, every dog has his day. In 2015, I pulled one of them. This is an Idaho late buck hunt. It had a 7% draw odds. I'd applied for it on and off since literally I was 12 years old. And I finally drew it when I was 46. It's the first hunt I've ever drawn in my life with 10% random draw odds. Or less, okay? So again, that's why I don't get all fired up about the draw hunts right there. You're just not gonna get very many good ones. But for this hunt, I put these things in my favor. It was the 1-3% draw hunts, those are the ones that make the front of the magazines. Just about every good deer hunter in here can name all the units in the state that have those kind of odds, because that's what gets all the press, okay? Well, a statistician taught me once a tag with 7% draw odds, as bad as that sounds, that's 7 times better chance of drawing a tag than one with 1%. So I don't look at the New Mexico 2Bs, I don't look at the strip, I don't look at any of that stuff. I don't even care about it. I like to watch what's going on down there, but I don't even care about it because I'll never touch those tags in my life. The draws are just too bad. So I put that in my favor. I applied for one that I actually had half of a chance of drawing. I made sure I'd been in the unit before. This is huge, guys. When the buzzer sounds on opening day, you don't want to be the first time there. And I know, oh, well, we'll show up a couple days early. Showing up a couple days early is fine, but there's lots of other guys doing that too, and you have a limited amount of energy is the other thing. You know, a lot of these hunts are open 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 15 days. You don't have the energy to learn all of that you need to know in that limited amount of time. Because I had spent time in the unit and I had actually helped a couple of friends that had drawn the tag before, and we're just talking just a few days. You know, I just went out with them on a couple Saturdays. Let's go look for deer. You know, helped them out. We never harvested one, but I was able to learn the unit a little bit more. So by the time I drew it, I already knew it's a heavy migration to winter range type of hunt. It's not a summer range hunt, and it may not even be a winter range hunt depending on the weather. Sometimes they don't make it all the way to the winter range by the time it closes. So I pre-scouted the unit. The draw results came out in June in Idaho, late June. I scouted the unit in the summer. Sorry, honey, I know you thought we were camping, but we were scouting. And there were no deer there. And I hear a lot of guys say that, like, oh, it does no good to scout, you know, winter range. And, you know, I mentioned that earlier. I don't agree. I think it's totally worth it. And I've driven across 3 states to scout a winter range hunt for the reasons that I told you. I don't want to pack it all in to just the open hunting days. I handled the logistics so that I could be mobile. I could have the right gear. I needed a road camp, but I also needed a horse camp, depending on what the deer were doing. I had all that planned out months in advance, and then obviously it was going to be a solo hunt. So I needed to make sure I was safe. People knew where I was, you know, that type of thing. And then I had to admit, I'm only good for a solo hunt up to about 10 days. After that, man, I just fall apart mentally. I just can't do it. And so that hunt was open like 6 weeks or something, early October into late November. I didn't even worry about any of that stuff. I didn't even start hunting in early November. I was off helping my friends then. I wanted to save it until the peak of the rut, which I knew was going to be right around kind of the 15th or the 25th, somewhere in there. So I just rested and saved my days until it opened, or excuse me, until those days came, and then I just threw myself into it. First day at camp, 10 below zero at night. Mid-teens during the day. That's cold. I mean, everything's frozen. Your water's frozen, everything's frozen. And that wears on you mentally. It really does. And that's why all that preparation prior to the hunt, that's why I do all that. Because then I go into my hunt confident. I'm not sitting in a frozen tent, you know, trying to unthaw water. You know, I know why I'm there. I'm there because this is where I need to be. I drive old trucks, but I make sure they always run well. Can't be having a breakdown in the middle of your hunt. This unit, I ended up right on the transitional range about, I think I started hunting about the 15th of November. There was already pretty deep snow there, but the deer were there, really hard to get around, you know, chained up on all fours. I spent the first couple of days just glassing from the roads. You know, I'm meeting hunters that are, you know, headlamps, you know, headed up the trailheads in the morning. Maybe they knew something I didn't, I don't know, but I just stayed back and I glassed country. Some of those mountains right there are a couple of miles away, but I'm just taking an inventory of the deer. Where are they? Where do I need to be? Mark talked about this in his seminar, narrowing it down, taking a great big chunk of country and narrowing it down. Because the deer now were on transitional range. If I just scouted that in the summer, they weren't there. Okay. I was seeing bucks like this size. That's kind of about a mid 170s, maybe bumping up against 180. I talked about how you've got to know your area's potential. So through my scouting, my contacts, you know, talking to lots of people, I knew this place. It hadn't kicked out a 200 inch deer in recent times that I knew of. And 180 to 190 is kind of what I figured. If I see something like that, especially as to getting down towards the end of the hunt, I better let them have it. That helps you pass up bucks like that, knowing that, okay? But it also keeps you from hunting unicorns that, oh man, I'm only gonna have this tag one time in my life. You know, I'm looking for 200. Man, that's a tough pill to swallow when the last day comes and you haven't seen one. There's another one there. That was another 170, 180 type buck. You can see where they are even during the rut, bedded in the cover. And that's why a lot of hunters walk right by them. So I hunted from the road camp 3, 4, 5 days, something like that. And then I got to where I couldn't get into the side canyons. They were just too much of a walk in the mornings. Always got my old man on speed dial. Dad, need the horses. Boom, only lost a half a day of hunting. He had the horses up there, and then I spread out from there. I only ended up hunting about two more days with the horses because what I was finding is I got out of that kind of core area where the roads were and off into the side canyons, the deer were leaving. Like, the tracks were getting old. You'd see 20 deer on a hillside one morning. That evening, they were all gone. There wasn't a deer around. You could tell they were leaving, okay? And the old me, that's where I would have panicked and started thinking, oh man, I got to shoot one. There's a 170. I better let him have it. But I knew, no, the deer are just leaving. I was totally prepared for it. And so I had to reset camp to the pre-scouted area that I told you that I scouted in the summer. And that was just winter range. Okay, you guys remember that? We walked up all those little canyons, hot, dry, 90 degrees, ain't been a deer track in there for 6 months. But it was great because I knew I'm pulling out of this camp. I'm going to go. I got to drive 20 miles, go up a canyon, unload the horses, and head in. I had all the gear ready. I think I quit hunting the transitional range about 11 o'clock in the morning. And by the next 11 o'clock in the morning, the next morning at sunrise, I was in my new camp. So I didn't only really lost about a half a day. Okay, that's my dad right there. God bless him. He doesn't have a snow machine. We had talked to friends. We made sure if we needed a snow machine, one was available. And again, he's on my speed dial. Dad, I'm headed to my backcountry camp. The problem with taking horses in the backcountry after the 1st of November, there's no feed for the horses. You can't stay back in there. And that's why a lot of guys, they're riding from the trailhead and then they're riding in and they're hunting. And every day they get a little bit later and they're not seeing the bucks. Well, it's because they're not in the prime areas at the prime time. And so if you look on the back of that snow machine, there's 150 pounds of horse feed right there. There's a propane bottle tied to the front of it. That killed my poor dad getting it all in there. Because if I go in with two horses, I take my camp, I don't have enough room for horse feed. All right. And so I either got to turn around, ride back out of the canyon, get more horse feed and bring it up, or call on the old man. My whole point in this is you'll see logistics are playing a heavy part in many of these hunts. Logistics are everything. And they have to all be worked out prior to opening day, okay? So here is a, we'll take you to camp. I'm saying right there is my dad had just pulled out of camp. It's about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. He dropped all the horse feed. He got out of there. I think it was the day before Thanksgiving or something. And I'm just talking about, I'm so glad I have a warm camp in there. I've got the horses. I got the horse feed. I'm sitting at the bottom of the winter range. I'm ready for this big influx of deer that's going to come in. But again, that all got down to my summer preparation. And then you'll see from there, this is where tracking come into play. Winter range sounds real sexy to hunt. Well, there's a lot of winter range that doesn't have deer on it. You know, they'll use it all winter, but there'll be big chunks of it that doesn't have any deer on it. So you can see I'm out taking assessments of where the tracks are, looking for places that people have not been. That's kind of a joke there, but that is the end of the four-wheeler trail. And if you could hear my voice right there, I'm saying virgin country lies beyond. Because I even on a tag with 20 or so other hunters on it, I still have to try to get myself where there's less people, okay? If you could hear me talking right there, I'm really excited. That's the night of the day I moved camp, okay? And I'm already into deer right there. I'm talking about a 170-160 buck that just ran across the trail right in front of me. And I am fired up because remember, I just left a deer camp. I moved 20 miles into a whole new place that I've never really hunted. And that was my first confirmation, the deer here. The research is worth it. Pretty good bull elk started pulling in there too. Okay. Luckily, I think that's the only video we got with sound here. So that's the only one we'll miss out on. And that's me riding back to camp. So even back in there 3 miles, I'm still up on top of the mountain when it gets dark. I have to ride back down to the bottom of the canyon, another couple miles to get to camp. That's what you gotta do if you want to make the best use of the tag. Even on the winter range, you can see the snow was getting really deep. And I had to refind the deer by the tracks and glassing. And on the fourth day, the deer really started to pour into there. I went from seeing, you know, 20, 30 deer a day to double, triple that. And the size of the bucks really started to come up too. You know, I went from seeing 160, 170 bucks almost everywhere to, you know, 180, heavy bucks, you know, nasty looking ones, nothing ready to shoot, but I knew, okay. And it's getting down to like, there's only about 3 days left of the season. It was so cold that you couldn't just sit in glass. That was not an option. You could glass about a half an hour and then you had to move. And even though I had the horses, I'm still out on foot. I don't ride the horses through deer country because that violates that whole rule I was talking about moving in deer country. Humans are loud. Horses are really loud. So I would tie the horses back and then I would glass a little bit and then I would still hunt, but I was mostly still hunting just to stay warm. Okay. And then just checking for tracks. That trail the day before didn't have a deer track on it. All right. You can see that lower right hand one. That's a buck track on there. It's not very big though, because it's not very heavy, but it's kind of blunt on the end. That's what you're looking for. And so, this trail, the same thing. The day before that was pure white snow. Sun went down, came back in the next morning. That's how many deer had moved at night. So even though I'm the only hunter back there, primo rut, I'm still not seeing the big bucks really out of the cover. They're hiding in these pockets during the day. They're not hiding from me. That's just what big mule deer do. You know, they don't wander around out in the open, even on some of these draw tags. At 3 p.m. on the third of the last day, it finally happened. Okay, it's getting down to crunch time. I'm sitting in a pile of rocks, just letting the sun shine on me, trying to get warm. And I spotted a buck about 600 or 700 yards below me coming out of one of those pine pockets all by himself. He had probably bred does all night and then went in there and laid down all day. He was tired and he got up. They're like hound dogs. They come out, they're smelling the ground. That's how you know they're in the rut and what they're doing. He was all by himself. And this gets down to that having to judge quickly. All I had time to do, I couldn't even get the spotter on the tripod. He was walking through some brushy little draws. I laid my spotter on my backpack, pulled that big old swarrow out, looked through it like a pirate. I could tell he had 5 points per side and he had eye guards and he had the best backs of anything I had seen in a long time. But you know, I didn't know, is he 175? Is he 200? I don't know. I just knew he was one of the better bucks I had seen and it's getting to be crunch time. I had to cut about 300 yards off of it because he's walking away from me, but he's not spooked, but they walk pretty fast. I had to cut about 300 yards off it. I got down there. He gave me one shot at 450 and I did hit him. And this is him right here. Let's see. Okay. He ended up about, I think it was 187 when I got back to camp and taped him. He was the best buck I had seen that whole hunt. So if I was holding out for a 200, I'd have been very disappointed. But all of that came down to all those logistics and tracking and glassing and then really, really still hunting. Because you can see even where I killed him, he ended up in the brush. I was up on that ridge back behind my hat right there where I killed him. And I still had to shoot down into that thick stuff to get him. There were other guys that had that tag that were hunting from that same trailhead. I never saw him back there. They were walking in, they were hardcore, they were all that stuff, but they were spending all their time in the bottom of the canyon walking in and out of there. Even if they left at 4 o'clock in the morning, and you only pull that off about 2 days, and then the next day you leave at 5, and the next day you leave at 6. I've done all that stuff. And you end up getting up, you're in the deer country, but you're not there when they're moving. And it's because you're relying on the reputation of the tag. Well, it's a draw hunt. It's November. They're going to be out. He wasn't. So you gotta have your logistics down to where you can be where the deer are when the deer are moving. Okay, in 2016, I drew a tag in the Idaho landowner system. You kind of have to know a landowner to do it there because they don't sell the tags. And that's why I don't want you to ever rule this stuff out. When I was 19, 20 years old, I thought, oh, that's just for the rich guys. You know, all the fat cats get to do that. No, you get out there, you start meeting people, talking to people. I started an outfitting business on private land and just to improve my own deer hunting and help other deer hunters. You just don't know what doors are going to come open out there. And so in 2016, I drew that tag in the landowner system. It's a 25% chance of drawing it in the public, and you'll see one of my friends drew it that same year. But I didn't just focus on that tag. It was Tag City that year. I had drawn a Utah tag with 16 points at 100% and a Nevada tag 80% at 9 points. And then I still picked up the Idaho OTC tag. Okay, if you've listened to any of my podcasts, I've said, hey, don't get too many tags. I'm talking about once the hunt opens. Sometimes I have a lot of tags prior to the hunt, and then I get out and I start scouting them and I start deciding which one am I going to hunt. I scouted the Nevada tag. I'd spent a lot of time in that unit scouting for friends prior to me drawing it. And in 2012, that unit was hot. I was seeing 180, 190 bucks every time that I went down there. But they doubled the tags in 2013. And so by the time I drew it in 2016, that buck population had really dropped. And those were some of the better bucks that I was seeing. So I spent 5 days down there in late July, and I ended up turning the tag back. Now, I know that's very controversial. And a lot of guys, oh, that's not fair. Somebody else doesn't get the tag. Baloney. I turned it back early enough, someone else got the tag, but I'm not going to give any state 8, 10, 15 years of my life that I can never get back and then keep a tag because it's the ethical thing to do. No, man, I'm going through my tags. I'm looking for the very best one. I go scout a unit in July and I can't find a big buck. I know I'm not going to find one. By the way, that was scouting for a September muzzleloader hunt. Those bucks would be in the same place. And so I just turned the tag back. Then my attention went to the Idaho OTC tag. I hunted archery. I really like archery hunting. I've taken a couple of my better bucks with archery gear, but I'm no muley slayer. I go years and years without getting one. And that was one of those years right there. I think I literally put in 10 or 15 days that year. I found a really good archery buck and I just couldn't get him killed. The Utah tag that I had on the 16 points, that was also a migration hunt. I knew that when I applied for it. I had scouted it the previous winter. I knew how much snow it took to get those deer in there. If you remember late October 2016, the weather got really, really mild and it stayed that way. And you Colorado hunters are going, oh yeah, it was terrible. It was no different for Utah. So I ended up turning that tag in too. And in Utah, I literally turned it in the night before opening morning from a little post office in small town Utah with the DOW on the phone that, look, I'm sending this tag back because I went to the unit. I had all the gear. I was ready to hunt it. I got there a couple days early. The deer just were not there. I'm talking to the locals, the farmers. They're like, we're going to have two or three big snowstorms to get these deer down here. So I turned that tag back too. So now I'm down to just that Idaho tag that I had. My point in telling you all that is that I'm always shopping. I'm always looking for big deer. And I'm not afraid to just take my best opportunity and bag the rest. This tag that I'm talking about would occur primarily on private land that I had access to, and it had some resident bucks on there. I had scouted it in the summer, and I hadn't seen anything really good, like maybe 24 inches. But with the dates going until about November 10th, I knew there'd be some pre-rut activity in there and probably some bucks coming in to chase some does. And then just hoping for some migration. It's right on a migration route to a major winter range, but the weather just came off dry. And so I had worked out the logistics to hunt the best dates. Okay, that was that first week of November. And as I said, warm, dry weather hit. The advantage to warm, dry weather, no fog. You can glass for miles, okay? Long afternoon naps. I mean, it's boring, but you have to work with the cards that are dealt you. And although I wanted cold and snow and winter, I didn't get any of that. So I just got out, got behind the glass. I spent about 21 hours behind the glass the first 3 days of the hunt. Didn't even need a rifle. It wasn't even really hunting. It was just scouting. Couldn't track, couldn't still hunt. Everything was dried out. Finally, on the third day, I spotted a good basket frame buck at about 3 miles. Okay, so this is the second buck I've had to judge quickly. I've looked at about 25, 30 bucks in that 3 days. Nothing fantastic. This buck's at 3 miles, crossing a little rim on a mesa. I got to look at him about 10 seconds on the skyline walking. And all I could do was just in my mind think, you know what? That is a good buck. Number one, the distance I'm looking at him at, I can see mass. Number two, all these bucks I've seen the last couple days, I didn't see anything like that. Okay, but was he 30 inches? Was he 25? Was he 33? I don't know. I just knew he was a good buck. And that's what I'm talking about. A lot of times with these big mule deer, they just don't give you a lot of time. The old me would have never, I'll tell the end of the story right now, I killed this buck, would have never killed this buck because I'd think, oh, I don't know what it was, it's a long ways away, you know, I'll just keep looking, okay? And I thought, no, he's probably the very best I'm going to find. There's only about 4 or 5 days of season left. I saw him crossing that last little round bump up on the right-hand side. That's actually a mesa. He was crossing by that little spruce that's up there. I was back here about 3 miles, and you can see that's really thick country. It's even thicker than it looks. And so with no snow, noisy conditions, I knew I'm not just going to go spot and stalk this buck. You know, number one, he's not going to lay down where I'm even going to see him. And it was so noisy and crunchy. I knew if I went walking in there, this is that whole moving in deer country thing, he's just going to stay in the cover. I won't even know I spooked him. He probably won't even leave. He'll just stay in the cover till it gets dark. So I started hunting that brush choke knob on Friday afternoon. And I stopped only for lunch for the next couple of days and set all day Saturday. I never saw him. And Sunday, I kind of started doubting my own tactics. So I backed out, came in from a different direction, about where you saw that picture of me sitting in the rocks right there. And right at daylight, I'd seen him on that round knob move over just a little bit, not to the big next knob, but the little tiny one. He was standing right on that thing at daylight when the sun came up. You know where my ambush point was? 250 yards across that saddle. I'd have killed him that morning if I'd have just sat there. But no, here I am off trying a new tactic that I knew wouldn't work. And of course, I took off after him. When I saw him, he was about 900 yards. I don't think there's a long-range shooter in the country that could have got him because he never stopped. The whole time I saw him, he was walking, smelling the ground. And he really only stayed out about 15 seconds where I could see him. So, I should have been up there. What was I doing? But that's okay. It gave me the resolve to get your butt back up there, quit screwing around and kill this deer. So from that was Sunday morning. So basically from Sunday mid-morning, I sat in that same place for two more days. I sat 10, 12 hours in the next 2 days, only stopped for lunch. I think I had to take a couple calls from work, so I had to sneak back to the truck. But Monday evening, he showed up. About 4 o'clock, glassing back down in that, right above my hat. See that draw that comes down there that kind of goes up to the saddle? I saw him down in that draw at about 700 yards away. I saw a deer. And he was in such thick stuff, I kept thinking, is that a buck? And every once in a while, I think I'd see an antler. And, you know, this went on for about 5 minutes, and he walked out into a little opening. And it was the first really good look that I'd gotten at him. This is the third time I'd seen him. And I could tell he wasn't very wide, but man, he had mass clear up at the top of his antlers. So I had to cut about 300 yards because he ended up down the hill from me, off of it. I got down there, poked my head up over the rise. I looked like a little cartoon character speaking over a bush, and got lucky. He had actually moved up the canyon another 100 yards, so he was only about 250 yards when I peeked over the brush. But he was alert. He had heard me move. How do I know that? Because when I first saw him, he was just smelling the ground, like a dog, right? Looking around. And then when I popped my head up over, he's looking right up at the hill. He wasn't looking right at me, but he had heard me up there, you know, scooting around or something. So, man, the alarms are freaking going, thinking, oh, crap, man, I've only got just a second to kill this buck. So I had my swirl tripod there, and I leaned it up, and I got up on him, and I rose up above the bush. Frick, he was gone. And so I get the glass up. I can't see him. And so I scooted down the hill maybe from here to that projector and got into a little area. So what was blocking me was all the brush in front of me. I got down, and just kind of a little window opened up. And he had moved about 15 yards, but he was still enough in the open I could get a shot at him. But in that little bit that I moved, you know, he went from going like this to, I thought, man, the gig is up. I got to kill this deer or he's going away. And once you spook them, especially at that yardage, they don't come back. Okay. So all I remember was checking through that little vortex scope that I got hair. And every time my heart beats and every time I shake, I still got hair. And I touched her off. Didn't know what happened. Nerve-wracking. Okay, this is right after the shot. Like 30 seconds after the shot. I'm still sneaking along, keeping my head down below that brush. An hour later, I've learned to hunt these bucks until you are standing over top of them with a loaded rifle and your finger on the safety. Because they will lay there, and they're cool cats, and they will let you walk up there, and you'll think they're deader than a mackerel, and they will jump up and bound away, and you won't get a shot, and they will embarrass you. So that obviously that deer was dead, but that's how I make sure right there. I've learned that the hard way. I wish we had more time to tell those stories. So anyways, you can see what kind of buck he was. I was really, really happy with him. He only ended up being a little less than 25 inches wide, but he's one of the heaviest bucks I've ever killed. And so he's the biggest, narrowest buck I've ever killed. I believe I couldn't have killed him any other way but ambush. I couldn't have spot and stalked. I couldn't have still hunted through there. I had to take the conditions that I was given and make a decision on how to hunt him. And I've killed a couple other of my very best bucks by ambush hunting. So I believe in it. There's just a couple more views of him right there. You see the kind of mass that he had. Okay, 2017, for those of you that live in the West, you remember it was a bad, bad winter. We had a lot of winter kill that year, okay? So I tried to leverage all those points that I had from those tags that I turned back to get out of the winter kill zone and wasn't able to pull it off, okay? I ended up with a second season Colorado tag in a solid unit. It took 6 points, but it was still a really tough hunt. Second season, unless you get a big old snowstorm and you know what you're doing, it can be really hard. Can I get an amen, Brady? Yeah, it's hard season, isn't it? Yeah. But I knew there was no hardly any bucks in the country I was used to hunting. We lost so many deer. So, true to form, I made sure I scouted it. I drove 650 miles all the way down to Colorado. Right around the eclipse. That's why I almost missed the eclipse party, honey. To just make sure I had laid eyes on the unit, all right? And I actually got kind of lucky, and I found a pretty nice buck when I was down there. He was about a 180 buck. He had some trash up on the top. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to look at gift nagging the molars. If I find that buck during the rifle season, I'll take him, okay? Some of this stuff is just driving around and looking at roads. You know, just like I said, you can't save up all this until opening day and then try to learn your unit. Okay, took my son's motorbike, just make sure I could access the trail system. That trail system would be closed once the season opened, so I wanted to, you know, have all the intel from that. I showed up 3 days early with a horse. It's not really a horse unit, but why did I bring a horse? Because all those trails were going to be closed. Horses are like guns to me. I'd rather have a horse and not need it than need it and not have it. So threw Charlie in the trailer, headed down there, got there 3 days early, started looking for that other buck. Could not find him. Okay? Got a big snowstorm the night before the season. That always helps. Got right back down in that canyon where I'd seen him, and there was about a 180 buck with some trash up on top of his antlers walking about 1,000 yards away from me down in the canyon. I didn't go right after him then. There were some other hunters over there. I wanted to keep an eye on him. I got to fast forward here. I didn't get this buck. He got away. I stayed there for 4 more days until there was hunters crawling all over that place. I should have just went down there and tracked him in that fresh snow, knowing what I know now. I should have just gone after him. He was leaving big old clomper tracks. I could have probably followed him all day. Okay? That's a 9-day hunt. Every day got worse, like it typically does after those snowstorms, hotter, drier, just not good hunting. The bucks pulled into stuff just like that. And on day 7, I glassed up the best buck that I had seen that whole time. But he was not fantastic. But I could tell he was probably mid to high 20s, not quite the buck that had got away from me on opening day. But this is what I'm talking about. I can't hunt unicorns. I can't just say 200 or bust. Oh, no. This is second season Colorado, and I got like 2 days left to hunt. I better go after that buck. But I still was being greedy. I thought, I'll hunt him on the last day. So I found him on Friday morning, closed on Sunday. I thought, I'll hunt him on the last day. Still some other country I wanted to check. So Saturday morning, I end up on a big mesa and hunted all morning, didn't see anything. And at the end of the morning, about 10:30, I'm looking over across the mesa. I'm like, you know, that buck I saw yesterday, he was only over there about a half a mile. You know, I should at least walk over there, get some intel. Maybe I'll set up an ambush for him when he gets up at dark or in the morning, you know, that kind of a deal. So I walked over there. I had never been there before. When I glassed him, he was like a mile and a half away up a canyon. So as I got out there and I'm kind of looking around, I'm on a little rim. I'm like, hey, I think this is that quakey pocket that deer was in. yeah, this is it. And I thought, well, it's 11 o'clock. They've probably been laying down a couple hours. Maybe he'll get up and feed here. I had the wind, good conditions. We'd had that snow. It hadn't totally dried out yet. I thought, this is perfect for still hunting. So I thought, I'm just going to still hunt around here. I don't want to spook all the deer out of here. I'll give them a chance to get up at dark or in the morning, but I should at least take a look at it. So I started pussyfooting around there, and I only hunted about 10 minutes. You know, I'm walking like this, you know, and then looking. And I might have made it 75 yards, and I heard a deer blow below me. Man, I didn't see any deer down there, and I start looking through the Quakies. About 75 yards, there's a nice mature three-point buck looking at me. That buck I glassed the day before was with a buck like that. And I thought, oh, man, they might be right here. And I watched him for a second, and he was looking just past me. He didn't see me, but he had heard me. And he was looking past me, and all of a sudden he just turned, darted into the cover. And he was headed for the other side of the Quakie pocket. And I thought, well, I got nothing to lose. They might come out the other end, and maybe that big buck's with him. So I ran up back around the Quakie pocket, come around and caught him just right. Out of that Quakie pocket comes this deer that I glassed up, by the way, had a giant body. Out of that Quakie pocket comes a big bodied buck and that other buck I had just spooked. This buck's body was twice as big as the deer he was with. This gets down to that quick judging thing that I'm talking about, though. I didn't, is he a 4-point? No, man, you just kill him. It's like one day left, you gotta go. It's go time, all right? And yeah, maybe I'm gonna shoot a big 2x3, I don't know. But I knew it was a 250, 300 pound deer. So, the deer are eating up the real estate. They're like 75 yards away. Get my gun up, I'm a little embarrassed. I fired one in the air.
Let's keep talking, man.
Trying to get my glove off on the safety off. But I do like to make it fair, so we'll call that one a warning shot. See, I fired one straight in the air. And I'm thinking, who's shooting? Oh, that's me. Jeez, embarrassing. So I got another shell in, and I'm shooting offhand. I'm shooting at him, running straight away, put it right on his neck, boom, and I could tell right as I shot. You know, your mind is a recorder. I could tell right as I shot, he took a left bound, and I knew I missed him. So I got another shell in it. This time I went down to my knee. Knocked that off, went down to my knee, and just as he hit the really heavy cover and I wasn't going to get to see him anymore, he turned just a little bit. I put it on that back rib and let her rip. You rarely see these big bucks go down. I didn't have time to put the video in, but it was almost like the last one I shot in the 2016 buck. I spent an hour hunting this buck until I was standing over him. And I was really glad I did, because when I got down there, I had not hit him real good. I'd hit him back here. He had laid down, but pussyfooting through the Quakies, he saw me and he got up and I got him. And this was him. Not one of my best bucks, but I was pretty dang happy for a second season Colorado buck. He ended up about 27 wide. Not a real good scoring buck, but I'll tell you what, I went home satisfied with the 6 points that I had spent, and it all got down to the logistics of that hunt. And ultimately, it was still hunting that killed those bucks. I may have been able to ambush those bucks. Nobody was hunting that little pocket right there. They may have got up right at dark and been right out there feeding, but they were feeding stuff just like that. You couldn't just, you know, spot them. You had to be right in their living room. Okay. So glassing, but I had to still hunt to kill him. Okay. Moving on to my last buck. Hard winters are not all bad, though. And this is what I've learned. Hard winters are a funny thing. Whether we like it or not, many of our winter ranges have too many deer on them. And a hard winter comes in, it trims back the deer, and the deer that are left are typically your bigger, heavier deer. And I'm talking does, fawns, bucks, everything, because that's why they made it through the winter, okay? They're just genetically better deer, all right? And I have seen some of my best bucks in the 2 and 3 years following hard winters. And I've been through 5 or 6 really hard winters over the years. And I think it's just a combination of less deer. Those little fawns and does, they eat that bitter brush too, all right? And those bucks have to compete with them. All right. So once there's not a lot of deer out there, there's not a lot of competition. Okay. I know that's pretty controversial. People think we should have more deer. I do too, but I'm just telling you, that's the facts. I've seen some of my best deer after these really hard winters. So knowing that, I thought, you know, Idaho, it's been a year and a half since that hard winter. I'm going to go out here and hit all my honey holes because I didn't draw anything in those other states. All those tags I turned back that year, boy, I'd have loved to have had them this year, but I couldn't draw them again. Point creep. That's why we don't want to pay too much attention to the draw hunts. They will leave you in the dust. Okay, OTC Idaho was all I had. I didn't even draw that landowner tag. I scouted many of the places that I had seen good deer. I've hunted basically from east of Boise into southeast Idaho. I know a lot of that country right there. And I just started hitting honey holes. And sure enough, I turned over 2 great bucks. The one up in the upper left, That's just his little running buddy. He's just a little 170 buck. The big buck's laying down there, lower right-hand corner between those two spruce, and he was a good buck. Heavy, carried it all the way to the top. This is only like the 25th of July, so he's still growing, okay? Here's a quick video of him. See him swing that around. He's a couple inches outside his ears on each side. You can see that big cheater on the back there. He was as good a buck as I was going to find. I figured he would finish off in the upper 180s, and with that big cheater back there, I knew he was going to be over 30. I also found, that's him too right there. I also found a good low country buck living in some foothills on some public land, and he was actually wider than that buck, but he wasn't as heavy, but he was a good buck. I didn't get a picture of him, and I decided to go hunt the high buck because the buck that was in the low country, that country's finicky. I found other deer before. The water's not reliable. Those little springs dry up and those deer will move 2-3 miles and then you won't even know where they are. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to hunt this high buck. I'll hunt that lower country when we get into October, September. The water's a little bit more predictable. So I spent my first 9 days on that high buck. Early archery is pretty much all glassing and spot and stalking. I still pay attention to the tracks. I do some ambush hunting, but it's primarily spot and stalk. And sure enough, I found him on opening day. And right in the exact same basin, a month later, this is 14 miles in, back on a horse, by the way. And you don't just run up there for the weekend. It's not that kind of place, okay? So I got back in there, found him opening morning, no stalk. Next morning, he was the highest buck bedded on the hill, so I made a stalk at him. And I'm at about 70 yards from him. It's about 11 o'clock in the morning, and there's a stick right there, and so I'm kind of like coming over the stick, and I finally got my foot down, and I look up, and he's out of his bed, and he's looking off to my left. I'm thinking, oh, crap, what's he doing? You know, why is he up? He shouldn't be up yet. You know, I'm still not within range. And then just by his body language, I could tell he wasn't spooked. He may have heard me, but he didn't identify it as danger, and he just turned, and he just walked down the hill into those other bucks. And so I backed out. I thought, you know, he's no longer the highest buck on the hill. I'll just leave him alone. Early archery season, the great thing about it, they'll stick around. Got up on top that night, took that picture of him that night right there. You can see how high he finished off. You know, he was all at 190 when he finished off. And sat up there all evening, watched him come out. He wasn't spooked. I thought, awesome, he'll be right back in there the next morning. They'll embarrass you. Never saw him again. 8 days. I do not know what happened to that buck. To my knowledge, I didn't spook him. If I would have spooked him, I don't think he would have came back out that night. He just wasn't there. I stayed there the next 8 days. He had a running buddy that was almost a twin to that 2016 buck. You can see how heavy he is up the top. He was that kind of buck. I don't look gift nags in the molars. So I went down there and I started hunting him. I gave him 6 days. Needed Muley Slayer there with me to show me how to get it done. Had him at 60 yards a couple times. Just never could get a shot. So I ended up pulling out of there. There was another nice buck up there that was with him. I didn't try to stalk him. I moved on to that low country buck just because he was easier to hunt. You know, I had just burned like, you know, 10 days of vacation. I couldn't just turn around and, you know, ride back into the back country. When they're 14 miles in, it takes a lot of recon and a lot of gear. So I moved on to the low country buck, spent 5 days looking for him, and sure enough, never did find him. I don't know what happened to him. And a couple of those springs had dried up. They had moved some cattle through there. I don't know. They don't put up with much. So by the time early October came around, both these bucks were in units in Idaho, where if you had the archery tag, you also have a rifle tag. So I just decided, you know what? I'm going back after the high buck. Big storm hit the day before the season. And this is the thing about draw hunts versus over-the-counter tag hunts. Over-the-counter tag hunts are not very sexy. A lot of guys are not very motivated to hunt them beyond opening day, okay? And so I don't know what happened. There's usually 2, 3, 4 guys hunting in there, and they're all good hunters. Nobody showed up. I was the only one. I couldn't believe it. I got in there 2 days early. I kept thinking, anytime there's going to be a pack string coming through. Nobody came. I don't know if the storm scared them off. I don't know. Nobody showed up. So it was just me and the bucks. But the problem with those big storms, when they hit those big mountains, they fog you out. And sure enough, I got fogged out. And I've learned when you're fogged out, don't just sit in camp and whine. Get out there and hunt. I checked all those basins that he had been in. I was just really careful not to go into them. Remember what I talked about obeying the wind? You drop off of those big wind ridges, your wind's going all over in those basins, just like a snake running around in there. The 3 points will stick around, but those big bucks, they'll just get up and they'll move. So I just bided my time. 5 days I was fogged in, and I hunted every day. And I made sure I was out there. I had a few, you know, the clouds would break and I'd get a glass for a minute. I saw a couple 160, 170 bucks, but I knew the area's potential. I'd been scouting and spending time in there. Didn't even point a rifle at them. Didn't even take it off safety. Tried not to pollute the most likely areas with my scent. The fifth day, finally, in the middle of the night, the wind came way up and it got really cold. So I knew that storm had cleared off. 5 o'clock in the morning, I threw that tent door open and I could see stars for the first time in 5 days. I thought, okay, I'm gonna be on top this morning. I'm gonna work my way in that basin. I'm gonna kill one of those big bucks. Got up there at daylight, just as the sun was coming up. And when it's 15 degrees and the wind's blowing 25 mile an hour, what does that do to exposed skin? It's cold. And it was just like that morning. And so I got up on top, and this is the whole moving in deer country thing. The old me, I'd just been hiking like a locomotive to get into that basin, get over there so I could lay eyes on that buck. And I've learned, no, these storms move all these deer around. You go walk on up there like a madman, you're going to start bumping deer. Bumping deer in the high country is worse than bumping them in the low country because they run a long ways. So I moved my way around the backside of the basin, and as I got around the back, there's about a 170 buck. The nicest buck I'd seen yet on the hunt, laying below me on just a little bench. And I glassed him for a minute. I wasn't going to shoot him because I knew the area's potential, but I'm like, why is he alone? Man, this is early October. He should not be alone. Kept glassing him. I couldn't see any other bucks around him. So the old me, I'd have just thought, the bucks I'm hunting, they're over there. I'm not going to worry about that buck. No, that buck will go tell the bucks that you spooked him. So it took me about 45 minutes. You know, and the sun's coming up, I'm thinking, I need to be up there another half a mile. Working my way around him, as I'm glassing, he's in his bed. I see other tracks about 100 yards to his south, and I'm like, okay, there are other bucks down there. He didn't make all those tracks by himself. So I just kept working my way around the ridge. It's sort of still hunting, but I'm not really in the cover. I think of still hunting in the cover, and got over, and once I got over the lip of the hill, I started glassing. Sure enough, big buck down there, 450 yards feeding with his head down. One more buck that only gave me just a couple seconds to judge him. Now, he was relaxed, but it was so flipping cold. By the time you get your pack off and you get your spotting scope out, I couldn't even get it onto the tripod. My hands were so cold. So I laid it on the pack. Oh, man, he's almost 30 on his frame, and he's got big cheaters. I judged that buck in like 4 seconds. Put the spotter away, put it on my back. I had him at 450. Why didn't I shoot? I could probably judge the wind at that far, but I was so cold, I was shaking. And plus, you know, I shoot light rifles, 6-7 pound rifles. The wind moves them. And every time I'd get the crosshairs on them, it wasn't 100% shot. The best way to make sure you don't miss is don't shoot till you know you can kill them. And I fiddled around for 3-4 minutes. I thought, I'm either gonna just miss and spook him out of the country, or I might get a Hail Mary in there. I'm not going to do it. So I dropped off the ridge. And this is hard to do. This is hard to leave a buck that you should be able to lay down and kill and start cutting distance off. But I'm not going to put all this work into chasing big bucks and then go spook one or wound one. I just don't want to do it, okay? So I spent about a half an hour moving 450 yards to 110. It turned into more of a still hunt than a stalk because I couldn't see him anymore. That's why those big bucks live below those trails, because the curve of the hill, they can stay below that and it keeps them out of trouble. So once I got down there, I couldn't see him anymore. So I pussyfooted my way over to the last place that I saw him. This is not where I killed him, but I put the picture up there because it's exactly what it looked like. It was strips of timber broken like that. And the last time I had seen him, he was with his little buddy that was like a 3 or 4 point. And he walked through an opening about the size of that one right above Charlie's saddle right there. So I got down there and I'm about 110 yards from that opening. And I just sit down, and now I'm getting close enough and I'm out of the wind now and everything. All that noise is gone. You know, they're going to hear me at that yard. You got to be careful. And the old me, no, I just keep stalking until I seen him. Because when I see him, they're going to stop and smile, and I'm going to shoot him. No, all you're going to see is a big white ass running straight away from me, and then he's going to get a tree between you and him, and you're never going to see him again. So I worked my way in there, and I just sat down. I had a big walking stick, propped it up against my knee, and I laid that rifle across it, put the rifle right there, and then just sat there with my glass. I probably sat there about 5 or 10 minutes, and I finally spotted that smaller buck back in some heavy trees, like what's behind there. That's why I put that picture up there. It was exactly like that. And I could only see parts of him, and it, you know, this is where you get in trouble and you shoot the wrong deer. And I thought, no, I got to make sure that's the right deer. Put the binoculars down, went right to the rifle, 10 power, looking. Finally, that's that little buck. But he's relaxed. He's just got his head down. He's not moving. Don't chase him. Just let him do his thing. So what if he lays down and they stay there all day and I don't get a shot? They'll get back up. That's what I'm thinking in my head. And just down below him, almost out of the picture, I see a part of another deer. And so I get the scope over on him. This probably went on 2 or 3 minutes. And I finally saw a big antler come around beside a spruce tree with a big cheater hanging off the side of it. And I could see the pocket. Everything else was covered and his butt was covered. It was just like you said. It was the Heavenly Father just shining a light right there. See, there's your shot. I thought, okay, I'll take it. Right behind the pocket, boom. And like it always is, you don't get to see him drop. I don't know why it is. I never get to see him drop. And the other buck was still standing there, because if you do it right, it's kind of like when you bugle elk in and you shoot them and all the other ones just stand there. He just stood there. I thought, oh, that's a good sign. Just let him stand there. Unless there's something wrong with this rifle, that buck is dead. I sat there about 5 minutes, and finally that little one, they start getting nervous when they see their buddy over there laying down, because he could see him, but I couldn't. And then he just started wiggling. Pretty soon, boom, he took off. So I thought, okay, I either got a dead buck over there or he's gone. Went over there, got on the tracks, you know, 270 Winchester short magnum, 3,400 feet a minute. He should be laying there. 3,400 feet a second. I get excited about this stuff. And he wasn't there, but there was blood. So I got on his tracks. I had to track him about 60 yards. And there he was. 34 inches wide, 6x7. I had never seen that buck before. And sometimes that's what those storms do. Now, did he migrate in from some other unit? No, he didn't. He was right there somewhere. That's why they live on those big mountains, because they can get away from you. That's an Idaho buck, yeah. Idaho OTC, okay? That's him right there. So out of those four bucks that I just went through, it's a little video of him right there. You can see him a little bit better as I turn it. Out of all those tags I just went through, one premium draw tag, one tag with a landowner, one tag that took 6 points, and then an OTC tag, the best buck come off of the OTC hunt. And so that's my whole point in this seminar, is you can't just focus on the best tags that are out there. And no matter what tag you're hunting, you got to be intentional about it. You got to bring all these techniques together. I didn't invent these techniques. These have been around since the modern rifleman and before. You bring all these techniques together for the tag that you have in hand. Make sure you know your area's potential, and don't get this romantic feeling you're going to see a big buck standing up on the hill looking at you.